Long walk along the river and through the woods, past the dilapidated dachas and the old men in dirty T-shirts working on cars that would never run again, past kids chasing their dogs in the dust. A few weeks before, the three of us had gone to a meeting of Moscow Tribune and heard Andre Nuikin, a popular journalist and activist, say that a coup d'état was not only possible but inevitable. Nuikin had been saying this for years, and we left the meeting that day thinking he was slightly off his rocker, like someone who had been poring over the Kennedy assassination just a little too long. Now, as we walked, I asked Seryozha and Masha what they thought. The most important thing, they said, was that they had decided they would never leave no matter what happened. "We have this last boat out policy," Masha said. "And that is that if things really go bad, if there are tanks in the streets and people are starving, if the worst happens, then we'll leave to save the kids. But not before that." "Besides, a coup would never hold," Seryozha said. "I'd be shocked if they were stupid enough to try it. More shocked if it lasted." That same afternoon, at a KGB compound outside Moscow known as ABC, Vladimir Kryuchkov convened a meeting of conspirators. It was another of the KGB's sanatoria, with a swimming pool, saunas, a movie theater, and masseuses. Kryuchkov could feel sure that the meeting would be confidential here. The compound was surrounded by guards and high walls. Gorbachev and his more liberal aides, Anatoly Chernyayev and Georgi Shaknarizov, were all on vacation in the Crimea. And who listened to Shevardnadze or Yakovlev anymore? Kryuchkov convened the session outdoors at a picnic table. Present there were Defense Minister Yazov, Prime Minister Pavlov, Politburo Chief Oleg Shenin, Military Industries Chief Oleg Baklanov, and Presidential Chief of Staff Valery Boldin. There were assorted snacks on the table, and everyone drank either Russian vodka or imported whiskey. "The situation is catastrophic," Pavlov said. "The country is facing famine. It is in total chaos. Nobody wants to carry out orders. The harvest is disorganized. Machines are idle because they have no spare parts, no fuel. The only hope is a state of emergency." Kryuchkov and the others agreed. "I regularly brief Gorbachev on the difficult situation," Kryuchkov said. "But he is not reacting adequately. He cuts me short and changes the subject. He does not trust my information." This was not the first such meeting of the hardliners, and these were the familiar complaints. But now the situation had changed, grown more urgent. Gorbachev was planning to return to Moscow to sign the new Union Treaty with Yeltsin and the other Republican leaders on August 20th. With Kryuchkov as their leader, the conspirators decided they could not wait. They would notify their other allies, Vice President Gennady Yanayev, Interior Minister Boris Pugo, and Supreme Soviet Chairman Anatoly Lukyanov. Months later, Lukyanov ruefully told the Washington Post that Gorbachev had surely adopted anti-socialist positions and that a state of emergency was required to save the existing order. But, he admitted, the opportunity to succeed had been hopelessly missed. Yeltsin and the other Republican leaders were now too strong, too popular. Still, the conspirators pressed on. They decided to send a delegation to the Crimea to confront Gorbachev. They would give him an ultimatum: support the state of emergency or step down. Someone suggested that one member of the delegation ought to be Boldin, Gorbachev's chief of staff, his liegeman for more than a decade. Yazov turned to Boldin and said, "Et tu, Brute?" On his trip home, Yazov recalled later, he felt a fleeting sense of pity for Gorbachev. If he had signed the treaty and then gone on vacation, the marshal thought, everything would have been fine. August 18th, 1991. The morning after he'd been arrested, Marshal Dmitry Yazov sat in full-dress uniform and answered the first questions of the Russian prosecutor. Yazov said he felt like an old idiot. He would spend the rest of his life wondering how he could have been so stupid, how he could do something that would bring such dishonor on him and the armed forces that he had served for a half century. The plot was slipshod from the first, he admitted, the product of occasional emotional discussions, and then the sudden impulse to head off Gorbachev and the Republican leaders before it was too late. We were already meeting earlier at various places. We talked about the situation in the country, Yazov said in his slow, slightly doltish voice. It was unavoidable that we came to the conclusion that the president was to blame. He had distanced himself from the party. Gorbachev in recent years had been going abroad, and often we had no idea in general what he was discussing there. We were just not ready to become greatly dependent on the USA, politically, economically, or militarily. Question. In what form did you make a decision? Yazov. There was no real plan for a plot. We met on Saturday, August 17th. Question. At whose invitation? Yazov. Kryuchkov's. Question. Where did you meet? Yazov. At a point in Moscow at the end of Leninsky Prospect. A left turn near the police post. There is a road there. At the end of the working day, Kryuchkov called and said we had to talk. I came. Then Shenin came. Then Baklanov. And then it was said, maybe we should go to Gorbachev and speak with him. Question. Why was there such a hurry? Was it because the Union Treaty was to be signed on the 20th? Yazov. Of course. We were not happy with this draft, and we knew the state would fall apart. Question. What brought up the idea of an emergency committee? Yazov. We were in Pavlov's office. Yanayev was there, and at about 9 Lukyanov came. He came by plane. He'd been on vacation. Lukyanov said, I can't be a member of such a committee. I'm chairman of the Supreme Soviet, a legal organ which is ruled by this and that. Naturally, I can do something. I put out an announcement saying that the result of the Union Treaty would be the destruction of the Constitution. After that he left. Yanayev was already rather drunk. The last good coup operation had been in Poland, in December 1981. On a freezing night between 2 and 3 a.m., the military and the secret police rounded up thousands of solidarity activists and sympathizers and locked them up in internment camps. The military regime secured the borders and then invaded its own country with tanks and troops, cutting up Warsaw and other key areas into carefully patrolled zones. They took over the radio and television stations. Over and over they broadcast martial music, the national anthem, and the words of the leader, the declaration of a state of war. In case anyone missed the point, the newscasters wore army uniforms. All demonstrations, all unions and student organizations were banned, all mail and telephone traffic censored. There was a curfew from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. The military council told the population that they were acting to prevent a reactionary coup. They were acting in the name of national salvation. It was a perfect operation. Perfect, but nothing new. In a letter dated September 26th, 27th, 1917, Lenin wrote a letter that later became a widely distributed pamphlet called Marxism and Rebellion. Just a few months from grabbing power, he was clearly obsessed with the need for absolute ruthlessness and efficiency. To approach a rebellion in a Marxist way, he wrote, that is, as one would an art, it is necessary not to lose a minute moving loyal battalions to the most important objects. To arrest the government, seize the telegraph and telephone. One cannot, at this critical moment, remain true to Marxism and not treat rebellion as an art. The successors to Lenin and Jaruzelski made feeble attempts to ape the old efficiency. From a factory in Pskov, they ordered 250,000 pairs of handcuffs. They ordered the printing of 300,000 arrest forms. Kryuchkov issued secret orders doubling the pay of all KGB men and called them back from vacation to go on alert. He cleared out two floors of Lefortovo prison and prepared a secret bunker in Lubyanka in case the leaders of the coup needed to find safe refuge. And, to keep pace with the times, they would carry out the coup under legal pretenses. A nation in crisis. A president taken ill. They would fill the stores for a few months, drawing on military stockpiles kept in case of war. The people would acquiesce. Hadn't they always? Gorbachev was resting in splendor. When he came to power in 1985, he built himself a magnificent place to rest, a compound in the Crimean town of Foros that cost the Soviet government an estimated $20 million. He and his family lived in the main house, a three-story structure with a central hall done up in marble and gilt. It was the sort of opulence you see sometimes when a sheik moves into Beverly Hills. There was a hotel for the staff and security guards, a guest house for 30 people, fruit trees, an olive grove, an indoor swimming pool, a movie theater, an elaborate security system, and an escalator to the Black Sea. It was a wonder that Gorbachev went on his vacation at all. At the worst moments, it was never really safe for him to leave Moscow. The Nina Andreeva letter in 1988 was published as he was leaving for Yugoslavia. The planning for the Tbilisi massacre of 1989 came when he was in England. The conservatives in the Politburo often made right-wing speeches when Gorbachev was in the Crimea. And now, despite all the warnings and omens, he left Moscow again. He took long walks on the beach with Raisa. He swam, watched movies, read volumes on Russian and Soviet history. His doctors did what they could for his bad back. Gorbachev also took time to write a speech for the Union Treaty signing ceremonies and a long article on the future, an article that even pondered the possibility of a right-wing coup. Gorbachev has said that he was not naive. He knew well what the conservatives were capable of. But he has also insisted that he had no prior knowledge that there would be a coup, or even a concerted demand for the declaration of a state of emergency. According to phone logs obtained by Cable News Network, Gorbachev talked four times with Kryuchkov on August 18th. He also talked with Yanayev, Shenin, Pavlov, and the Deputy Prime Minister, Vladimir Shcherbakov. Sometime after 2 p.m., Yanayev called Gorbachev and asked about meeting him at the airport in Moscow when he returned from vacation the next day. They agreed to see each other then. Yanayev, who was probably making sure the mark was still in place, was the worst sort of party nonentity. He was a vain man of small intelligence, a womanizer, and a drunk. I am not sure it is possible to describe just how hard it is to acquire a reputation as a drunk in Russia. And Yanayev was not merely a drunk, he was a buffoon. On the day he went before the Congress for confirmation as vice president, one of the deputies asked him if he was a healthy man. "My wife has no complaints," Yanayev said, and snickered. At around 4 p.m., Georgi Shaknarizov, one of Gorbachev's last remaining liberal advisers, called to check on details for the trip to Moscow. Then, almost as an afterthought, Shaknarizov asked Gorbachev about his health. Gorbachev said he was fine except for his chronic back pain. Gorbachev had worked hard on his speech for the treaty signing, and now he wanted to spend some time with Raisa and their daughter Irina, son-in-law Anatoly, and granddaughter Oksana. But at 4:50, the chief of Gorbachev's security detail told him that they had unexpected visitors, including Yuri Plekhanov, the head of the KGB's 9th Directorate, the division charged with the security of the leadership. Gorbachev picked up a phone to find out what this was all about. He had called no meetings, and he was not accustomed to unannounced visitors. The line was dead. Then he picked up another, also dead. Gorbachev was stunned. Raisa came in to see what was going on. "Mikhail Sergeyevich has 8 or 10 telephone operators, and all the phones were silent," she said later. "I picked up the receiver and checked it out, and all the phones were silent, even that of the commander-in-chief. We have this phone everywhere, in our country house, in our flat, everywhere. It's under a kind of lid, and we do not even remove dust from this phone because we are not supposed to remove the lid." He picked up the receiver on that phone, and there was silence there. We knew that was it. There was nothing else we could do. Before the visitors got inside the house, Gorbachev knew perfectly well something was very wrong. He called his family around him and told them that anything could follow this. They, in turn, said they were ready to see it through with him to the end. Later, when she described the scene, Raisa seemed to refer to the murder of the Romanov family after the Bolshevik coup to describe the depths of her own worst fears. "We know our history and its tragic aspects." "I paced the room and thought," Gorbachev recalled, "not about myself, but about my family, my granddaughters. I decided, in this situation, it is impossible to value my own skin." The delegation arrived. Plekhanov, Shenin from the Politburo, Baklanov of the military-industrial complex, Gorbachev's personal assistant, Boldin, and, representing the army, General Varenikov, the head of ground forces. Gorbachev led them to his study. "Who sent you?" he said. "The committee," one of them said. "The committee appointed in connection with the emergency." "Who appointed such a committee?" "I didn't appoint such a committee, and neither did the Supreme Soviet." Varenikov told Gorbachev he had little choice. Either go along or resign. "You are nothing but adventurers and traitors, and you will pay for this. I don't care what happens to you, but you will destroy the country. Only those who want to commit suicide can now suggest a totalitarian regime in the country. You are pushing it to a civil war." Gorbachev reminded the delegation that there was to be a signing ceremony of the Union Treaty in Moscow on August 20th. "There will be no signing," Baklanov said, according to Gorbachev. Then, Baklanov said, "Yeltsin's been arrested. He'll be arrested. Mikhail Sergeyevich, we demand nothing from you. You'll be here. We'll do all the dirty work for you." Gorbachev said he would play no part in their adventure. The delegation continued to press. They gave Gorbachev a list of the members of the State Committee for the State of Emergency, the GKCHP. Gorbachev was especially stunned to see the names of Yazov and Kryuchkov. He had plucked Yazov out of obscurity to make him defense minister precisely for the sake of having his own man. And besides, he was not bright enough to be disloyal. Yazov, Alexander Yakovlev would say, is no Spinoza. Kryuchkov, who was perhaps the most forceful and determined of all the plotters, surprised Gorbachev because he had come through the recommendation of their mutual mentor, Yuri Andropov. Gorbachev thought of Kryuchkov as a cultured man, someone who had been abroad, seen something more than the inside of Lubyanka. But as the prosecutor's report on the putsch said, for Kryuchkov, Gorbachev was a madman. Gorbachev destroyed the system that had given him everything, servile aides, the respect of his foes, and a comfortable, even splendid lifestyle. Could a person in his right mind get rid of all that? Time and again, Kryuchkov urged Gorbachev to break up demonstrations, to show at last our strength. And when Gorbachev would refuse, Kryuchkov would tell his friends, "The president is not responding to events." Boldin was a terrible betrayal, too. He had started working for Gorbachev in 1978 and had his absolute trust. Boldin was the chief of staff. He vetted every appointment, controlled absolutely the flow of paper to the president's desk. Along with Kryuchkov and Boldin, the other chief plotter was Oleg Baklanov, a figure little known to the public, but one with tremendous power. Baklanov's chief interest in a coup was clear. He wanted to prevent any deterioration of military spending or might. In one speech prepared for the April 1991 plenum of the Central Committee, he wrote that current policy had caused the Soviet Union to fall practically under the dictate of the United States. According to one of the country's leading weapons scientists, Pyotr Korotkevich, Baklanov froze a major plan worked out by specialists in the hierarchy to create a smaller but professional army, demilitarize the economy, and reduce military spending by half. The rest of the list was less surprising. Pavlov and Yanayev were obvious enemies of radical reform, though they were too bumptious, too drunk, to have acted alone. The rest were symbols of the conservative interests. Alexander Tizhakov, the president of the Association of State Enterprises, had given Gorbachev an ultimatum the previous December to end strikes and impose economic discipline. "You want to frighten me," Gorbachev had said then. "Well, it won't work." And there was Vasily Starodubtsev, the head of the Union of Collective Farm Chairmen, an ardent opponent of private farming and private property. Gorbachev tried now to persuade the delegation to take up the question of a state of emergency in the parliament. There could be a full debate. Let the Supreme Soviet decide. "If you go to a state of emergency, what are you going to do the next day?" Gorbachev told them. Varenikov said they were carrying out this mission because the committee would not allow separatists and extremists to dictate the future of the country. "I've heard all this," Gorbachev said. "Do you think the people are so fatigued that they will just follow any dictator?" But it was no use. "It was a conversation with deaf mutes," Gorbachev said later. Their cycle was in motion. As the delegation was preparing to leave at about 7:30 p.m., Baklanov stuck out his hand to shake hands with Raisa Maximovna. She looked at him, said nothing, and walked away. The delegation rode back to the Belbek airport. In the front seat, Plekhanov spoke on the radiophone to Foros, giving further instructions on the isolation of the president. In the back, the others spoke in short, disgruntled phrases. They had thought Gorbachev would give in to their demands, and he hadn't. On the trip back to Moscow, they began to drink. Raisa, the Gorbachev's daughter, Irina, and Gorbachev's aide, Anatoly Chernyayev, had waited outside the study until the meeting was over. After the plotters left, Gorbachev looked at Chernyayev and said, "Well, have you guessed?" "Yes." Gorbachev described the demands and his replies in terms I cannot repeat with ladies present. He showed Raisa a list of the conspirators he had copied down, and added at the bottom, "Lukyanov?" He still could not see that his great and loyal friend from college days had turned on him too. Gorbachev said he would not go along with a state of emergency or a return to dictatorial rule. "I was always an opponent of such measures," he said later, "not only for moral and political reasons, but because in the history of our country they have always led to the deaths of hundreds, thousands, and millions. And we need to get away from that forever." Raisa said that it would be best now, if there was anything to discuss, to talk out on the balconies and on the beach, the better to avoid the listening devices that were obviously in place and working. When they arrived at the Kremlin that evening, Vice President Yanayev and Prime Minister Pavlov, the twin fools of this low comedy, saw Kryuchkov, Boldin, Shenin, Pugo, Yazov, and the rest sitting at a long conference table. Lukyanov called from his car and said he was on the way. No one sat at the head of the table, the president's chair. "A catastrophe is taking place," Kryuchkov said. "There would soon be an armed uprising against the leadership. They were going to take over key points, the television tower at Ostankino, the rail stations, two hotels. They had heavy arms, missile launchers, everything. They must be stopped, and there were only a few hours in which to do it. Then Plekhanov chimed in. He and Bolden had just come back from Foros. Gorbachev was ill. "It's either a heart attack or a stroke or something," Bolden said. Yanayev hesitated. He said he could not sign the document creating the emergency committee and making him the new president. Kryuchkov pressed him. "Can't you see," he said, "if we don't save the harvest, there will be hunger, and in a few months the people will be on the streets. There will be a civil war." Yanayev was smoking one cigarette after another. He said he wanted to wait to meet with Gorbachev before taking action, and besides, he did not feel morally prepared or otherwise qualified to be the president. But the men around the table kept after him, stressing that Gorbachev was sick, that the situation would be temporary. Investigator. Why did it fall apart? Valentin Pavlov. Most of those present, at the Kremlin on the 18th, did not understand what the whole thing was about. Emergency measures had been discussed before. They'd been discussed in the spring. So there was nothing unusual about it. But when it came to Gorbachev being sick and no one knowing what was wrong, when it was unclear whether or not he could fulfill his duties, then we hesitated and decided to transfer it to the Supreme Soviet. Yanayev did not want to sign it. He kept saying, "Guys, I do not know what to write. Is he sick or not? It's all hearsay." The rest said, "Take the decision." Whose word did he take? Hard to tell. Lukyanov arrived late to the meeting, carrying a copy of the draft Union Treaty and the Soviet Constitution under his arm. Eventually, after listening to Lukyanov describe how the Supreme Soviet would eventually legitimize the state of emergency, Yanayev began to waver. "Sign, Gennady Ivanovich," Kryuchkov said. And finally he did. In his trembling hand, Yanayev signed the documents grabbing power from his president. Then he passed the document around the table. One after the other, Yazov, Pugo, Kryuchkov, Pavlov, and Baklanov put their names to the decree declaring the state of emergency. Now Alexander Besmertnik, Shevardnadze's successor as foreign minister, arrived. He had been on vacation and had flown to the meeting having no idea what was going on. Kryuchkov took him into an anteroom. "Listen, the situation in the country is terrible," Kryuchkov said. "A chaotic situation has emerged. It's a crisis. It's dangerous. People are disappointed. Something should be done, and we decided to do something through emergency measures. We have established a committee, an emergency committee, and I would like you to be part of it." "Is the committee arranged by the instructions of the president?" Besmertnik asked. "No," Kryuchkov said. "He's incapable of functioning now. He's flat on his back at his dacha." Besmertnik asked for a medical report, but Kryuchkov refused. Something was obviously very strange about this, though Besmertnik's instincts either were not sharp enough, or he saw danger and tried to negotiate a safe course for himself. In the days to come he called in sick and refused to come out publicly against the coup. But at least he turned down Kryuchkov. "I am not going to be part of this committee, and I categorically reject any participation in that," he said. As they went back to the meeting, Kryuchkov told the others that the foreign minister had refused. Besmertnik told the group that their idea would isolate the country. It would bring on sanctions from the West, maybe a grain embargo. The committee seemed glum. They so wanted the appearance of consensus, of legality, before the world and the people. "We still need a liberal," Kryuchkov said. Then the so-called committee began to fall apart and to split, Pavlov told the prosecutors months later. The whole situation was odd. Besmertnik fell sick. I was sort of carried out of the room. I did not think it would end this way. If someone had not decided out of foolishness to bring in the military hardware, nothing at all would have happened. At one point in the Kremlin meeting, Lukyanov asked what sort of plan had been worked out, what the details of the state of emergency were. In fact, was there a plan? "Why do you say that?" Yazov said. "We have a plan." But as he told the prosecutors later, Yazov knew there was nothing. "I knew we had nothing except the sketch that we had been absorbed in that Saturday at ABC. This was no plan, and I knew very clearly that, in any case, we had no real aim at all." August 19, 1991. Olivar Kakuchaya, the director of Vremya, was dead asleep when the phone rang at 1:30 a.m. It was his boss on the line, the head of state television and radio, Leonid Kravchenko. "Olvar, what's your address?" Kravchenko said urgently. "Are you sending someone to me?" "I want to send a car." "What for?" "I'll tell you when you get here." "Can't this wait?" Kakuchaya asked. "No, it can't," Kravchenko said. "We have an emergency." The morning show had to be changed drastically. He'd explain when they got to the studios at Ostankino. Kravchenko told Kakuchaya that they needed two newscasters to get ready, one man and one woman, or whoever could get to the studios fastest. The car came for Kakuchaya in no time and brought him to work. Kravchenko called again, this time from his car on the special Kremlin line. "We're on the way," Kravchenko said. "Go outside and I'll give you the script you need." "How long will you be?" "I'll be there in 7 minutes." Kravchenko's car pulled up in the parking lot. He was usually a dapper man, an apparatchik for the television age, but now he seemed absolutely pale. He said that he had just gotten into bed when he was called and told to come immediately to the Central Committee. He was given a stack of documents, the appeals and pronouncements of the Emergency Committee, that would begin going out over the air at 6 that morning. He was told to create an atmosphere on television similar to that on the day of a state funeral. Somber, classical music, deadpan announcements. Kakuchaya took a quick look at the documents. They seemed to have been typed in haste on an ordinary typewriter. And there was Yanayev's signature, a hasty scrawl. Kravchenko told him that soon there would be tanks around the TV tower. No one should go outside. Use the underground tunnels connecting the various buildings to get around. And obey orders. Gennady Yanayev, still buzzed from drink, took power at 4 a.m. 30 minutes later, Marshal Yazov dispatched coded telegram 8825 ordering heightened alert status for all military units. Soldiers were ordered back from furlough. The Taman Guards, the Dzerzhinsky and Kantomirovskaya mechanized divisions, and several units of the Ryazan Airborne Division would occupy the city of Moscow. At the Ministry of Defense, Yazov repeated Kryuchkov's elaborate conspiracy theory about an imminent anti-Soviet coup and the need to take the upper hand. "There will be people in the crowd who will throw themselves in front of tanks or throw Molotov cocktails," Yazov warned his commanders. "I want no bloodshed or carnage." It was a hellish morning for Prime Minister Pavlov. He had stayed up most of the night drinking with Yanayev, and now Kryuchkov was trying to reach him to organize planning sessions at the Kremlin. At about 7 a.m., one of the Kremlin doctors, Dmitry Sakharov, was summoned to Pavlov's dacha and told only that the Prime Minister was very unwell. "Pavlov was drunk," Sakharov testified later. "But this was no ordinary simple intoxication. He was at the point of hysteria. I proceeded to give him attention." The barracks of the Kantomirovskaya Mechanized Division in the town of Narofominsk outside Moscow were quiet, and Private Vitaly Chuganov, a young man with wheat-blonde hair from the city of Ulyanovsk, was in the middle of a deep, untroubled sleep. These were the last sweet moments before Monday reveille and another week of training. Chuganov had thought he would be among the first generation of Soviet soldiers blessed by the rise of a peaceable kingdom, a country in which a policy of new thinking ensured against another Afghanistan, another occupation of Eastern Europe. Suddenly an officer burst into Chuganov's barracks, shouting his charges out of bed. There were no complicated explanations, nothing about Gorbachev or a state of emergency. "We all thought it was one of those training alerts, and we quickly got everything ready to go," Chuganov said. Soon he was inside his armored personnel carrier, part of a huge convoy headed for Moscow. Chuganov and his buddies were confused, not quite sure why they were taking the highway north into the city at such a fast clip and churning up the asphalt. Along the way, Chuganov could see a few people waving at the tanks and the armored personnel carriers, people shouting at them to turn around and go home. Slowly, the young soldiers began to understand, Chuganov fastest of all. His father had been in a tank when the Soviet army invaded Prague in 1968. He'd always told his son how scared he was that day. The commanders had told him that the Czechs would give them boxes of chocolate and the chocolate would have poison inside them. "Watch out for poisoned wine," they told them. And then, as his tank rumbled into the city, he heard the insults. "Occupiers! Pigs, go home!" Looking out at the road now, Chuganov thought that he was headed for something far worse than his father had ever known. The coup went on the air at 6. The announcers, so obviously nervous and confused, began to read the documents that had been delivered to Kravchenko at the Central Committee. "We are addressing you at a grave, critical hour for the future of the motherland and our peoples. A mortal danger has come to loom large over our great motherland. The policy of reforms, launched at Mikhail Gorbachev's initiative, and designed as means to ensure the country's dynamic development and the democratization of social life, have entered for several reasons into a blind alley. All democratic institutions created by the popular will are losing weight and effectiveness right in front of our eyes. This is a result of purposeful actions by those who, grossly violating the fundamental law of the USSR, are in fact staging an unconstitutional coup and striving for unbridled personal dictatorial powers. The country is sinking into the quagmire of violence and lawlessness. Never before in national history has the propaganda of sex and violence assumed such a scale, threatening the health and lives of future generations. Millions of people are demanding measures against the octopus of crime and glaring immorality." Yeltsin was eating breakfast at his dacha in the village of Usovo when the calls started coming in. Gennady Burbulis, Ruslan Khasbulatov, and all the other Russian officials in the smaller dachas in the woods near Yeltsin's quickly gathered round. Yeltsin had gotten some hints from agents in the Russian Republican Secret Service that a coup was coming. With Gorbachev flirting to the end with his own worst enemies, Yeltsin knew that a coup was possible. But until now he hadn't thought it would actually happen. And now he had to act without hesitation. The Leningrad mayor, Anatoly Sobchak, heard about the coup by phone at his hotel room in Moscow. Tanks were on their way, he was told. Sobchak called his driver, and together they headed out of town at top speed for Yeltsin's dacha. Along the way they saw armored personnel carriers and tanks. One tank had fallen into a ditch and was burning. Sobchak, like Yeltsin and around 70 other reform politicians, including Alexander Yakovlev and Edward Shevardnadze, were on KGB arrest lists. But so far the secret police had made only a few arrests of some minor officials. Sobchak made it to Usovo untouched. Sobchak saw that Yeltsin was already determined to do what he could to shore up resistance to the coup. Yeltsin had called the leaders of the biggest republics and was taken aback by their calm, their lack of resolve. They told him they did not have enough information to act. Yeltsin was on his own. As he strapped on a bulletproof vest and then his shirt and suit, Yeltsin said that he and his aides would head for the White House, the massive Russian parliament building on the Moscow River. Without saying so, they would follow almost precisely the tactics of the Lithuanians in January. Use the parliament building as a barricade, an oasis and symbol of democratic resistance. Communicate with the outside world by whatever means possible. Yeltsin told his aides to convene immediately a non-stop session of the Russian parliament. As Yeltsin got into his car, his daughter said, "Papa, keep calm. Everything depends on you." After following the convoy part of the way to the city to make sure Yeltsin got past the tanks, Sobchak and his driver peeled off for Sheremetyevo Airport to wait for the first flight home to Leningrad. When he got to the waiting lounge, Sobchak saw three bodyguards coming at him. For a moment, he thought he was finished. To the contrary, they were bodyguards from the Russian KGB there to make sure that the mayor caught his plane. By 9 a.m., tanks surrounded Moscow City Hall. Soldiers had taken down the Russian tricolor and replaced it with the red Soviet flag. Tanks were taking positions in all the key points of the city. The TV and radio stations, newspaper offices, Lenin Hills, the White House. A journalist called General Yevgeny Shaposhnikov, the commander of the Air Force. Shaposhnikov had listened to Yazov's commands and explanations of the coup, but he made no secret to the reporter that he was revolted by what had happened. "Let the sons of bitches comment on what they are going to do with the country," he said. While Yazov worked at the Ministry of Defense and Kryuchkov at Lubyanka, Yanayev sat in his Kremlin office wondering what it was he was supposed to do. Yuri Golik, the chairman of the Supreme Soviet Committee on Legislation, got through the gates of the Kremlin without any problem and went immediately to see Yanayev. "Is it a putsch?" Golik asked. "It's a putsch," said Yanayev. Later, Vadim Bakatin, a member of Gorbachev's defense council, also came to see Yanayev. Bakatin, like Golik, was loyal to Gorbachev, and he demanded an explanation. Before he could even work up his temper, Bakatin noticed what bad shape Yanayev was in. "I've been here since 4 o'clock in the morning," Yanayev said, pacing, smoking, excitable, bags under his eyes. "I don't know myself what is going on. They came and tried to persuade me for 2 hours. I didn't agree, but they finally persuaded me." "Who came?" "They came." The Kazakh leader, Nursultan Nazarbayev, called Yanayev, who seemed to be in a daze, drunken or otherwise. "He didn't seem to know what was going on," Nazarbayev told reporters in Alma-Ata, the Kazakh capital, "or why I was calling, or even who I was." Yanayev's desk was stacked with unread documents, many of them months old. Usually he let his aides do all his serious work for him. Among those aides was Sergei Bobkov, the son of Philip Bobkov, Kryuchkov's trusted deputy at the KGB. But while Yanayev was foggy at times, obsessed with love affairs and the bottle, he kept on his desk one document that made it clear that the coup itself was more serious than he was, that the real powers behind it, Kryuchkov, Baklanov, Boldin, and Yazov, knew their history and the methods of the old regime. Regarding certain axioms of the extraordinary situation. 1. We must not lose the initiative and enter into any kind of negotiations with the public. We have often ended up doing this in an attempt to preserve a democratic facade. As a result, society gradually becomes accustomed to the idea that they can argue with the authorities, and this is the first step toward the next battle. 2. One must not allow even the first manifestations of disloyalty. Meetings, hunger strikes, petitions, and information about them. On the contrary, they become, as it were, a permitted form of opposition, after which even more active forms will follow. If you want to proceed with a minimal amount of bloodshed, suppress contradictions at the very beginning. 3. Do not be ashamed of resorting to clearly expressed populism. This is the law of winning support from the masses. Immediately introduce economic measures that are understandable to all, lowering of prices, easing up on alcohol laws, etc., and the appearance of even a limited variety of products in popular demand. In this situation, do not think of economic integrity, the inflation rate, or other consequences. 4. One must not delay in informing the populace about all the details of the crimes of one's political opponent. At first, they will avidly search for information. Exactly at this point, one must bring down an information storm of exposure, the revelation of guilty groups and syndicates, corruption, and so forth. On other days, the information about one's opponent should be given in an ironically humorous key. The information must be graphic and as simple as possible. 5. One must not crack the whip with direct threats. Better to start rumors about the strictness of the regime and the control of discipline in production and life, as if there were systematic raids on stores, places of relaxation, and others. 6. One must not be slow in dealing with personnel decisions and reassignments. The population should know who is being punished and for what evident reasons, who is answering to whom for what, and to whom the population should turn with its problems. Before going to the Washington Post Bureau on Kutuzovsky Prospect, where she was working as a translator, Masha Lipman watched the bland declaration of a state of emergency. As she stared at the television, her first thoughts were of her children, her 6-year-old daughter Anya, and her 16-year-old son Grisha. She was terrified. Suddenly, these years of promise seemed betrayed. After years of thinking the problem through, Masha and Seryozha had decided against emigration. They'd cast their lot with Moscow. Now all she could think was, will Anya be indoctrinated as we were? Is it all coming back? Will we emigrate? Should we? Can we? Nadezhda Kudinova, a seamstress at a parachute factory on the edge of town, arrived at work. On the way, she had heard some vague rumors on the bus that the newscasters were announcing that Gorbachev had resigned for health reasons and that Yanayev and some unpronounceable committee, the GKCHP, had taken power. It all seemed so vague and unreal. The factory director immediately gathered all the workers and insisted that they all stand by the emergency committee, that what the country needed now was stability and discipline in the workplace. Kudinova looked out the window. There was nothing to see, nothing to hear. On the radio, the announcers repeated the decrees of the committee over and over again. She and her friends began talking about what they could do, whom to support. At the factory, opinion was split down the middle. Half were outraged. Half thought that maybe life would be better now without Gorbachev. Maybe there would be food in the stores for a change. Kudinova thought to herself that the workers who were taking sides with the committee were counting on a passive country. As the day went on and she heard that Yeltsin had begun organizing the resistance at the White House, Kudinova brightened. Maybe I should start writing some leaflets, she thought. On her way home, she saw the tanks. She saw how the tanks had chewed up the road, a violation. She saw the crowd beginning to gather at the White House, and she made a decision. She would protect the president she had voted for just 2 months before. She had no thought of Mikhail Gorbachev. She went to the White House for Yeltsin, for an independent Russia. It wasn't about Gorbachev, she thought. Gorbachev had gotten what he deserved.
Yeltsin arrived at the White House at around 10 a.m. He and Ruslan Khasbulatov, the chairman of the parliament, and Ivan Tsilayev, the Russian prime minister, drafted an appeal to the citizens of Russia, denouncing the putsch as a reactionary, unconstitutional coup d'etat and calling for a nationwide strike. Khasbulatov and Vice President Alexander Rutskoy, a war hero in Afghanistan, began broadcasts from a makeshift radio station inside the parliament building, the White House. Vladimir Boxer, a young pro-democracy politician, organized a phone network of activists to come to defend the White House. Yeltsin dispatched his foreign minister, Andrei Kozyrov, to Paris to seek Western support and establish a Russian government abroad if the resistance was crushed. By 11, the depression in the city was beginning to lift just slightly, said Masha Lipman's husband, Seryozha Ivanov. People riding in the trolleys were laughing at the tanks, mocking them. Children climbed on the tanks and asked the young soldiers how to drive. Pretty young women teased the recruits and said that maybe they should all go home and do something more interesting than sitting around on a tank. Then, just after noon, Yeltsin walked down the front steps of the White House and clambered up on a T-72, tank number 110 of the Taman Guards. It was an indelible image that would set the tone for the next 3 days.
As a small crowd of demonstrators and reporters listened, Yeltsin's voice boomed out. "Citizens of Russia," he began, "the legally elected president of the country has been removed from power. We are dealing with a right-wing, reactionary, anti-constitutional coup d'etat. Accordingly, we proclaim all decisions and decrees of this committee to be illegal. We appeal to citizens of Russia to give an appropriate rebuff to the putschists and demand a return of the country to normal constitutional development." Then Konstantin Kobets, a retired general, now appointed Russian defense minister by Yeltsin, climbed aboard and addressed not only the citizens but the soldiers of Russia. "I am the defense minister of Russia," he said, "and not a hand will be raised against the people or the duly elected president of Russia." Kobets had led a battalion during the Prague invasion in 1968, and he said he was not about to repeat his mistakes. He would organize the military resistance and try to convince the officers and troops that they could not, as soldiers or citizens, follow the commands of a junta. Yeltsin had been criticized in recent months for flirting too much with the military. He had spent much of his campaign in places like the Tula military bases, and, over the objections of many radicals in the parliament, made Rutskoy his vice president. Now he was counting on that relationship to pay dividends. Rutskoy responded instantly and went on the radio. "Comrades, I, an officer of the Soviet Armed Forces, a colonel, a hero of the Soviet Union who has walked the battle-torn roads of Afghanistan and knows the horrors of war, call on you, my brother officers, soldiers, and sailors, not to act against your own people, against your fathers, brothers, and sisters." Outside the White House, the first demonstrators cheered as the gunners in 10 tanks of the Taman Guards turned the barrels of their guns away from the parliament. The attackers were now ready to defend the White House. Private Chuganov sat in his tank, parked in the Lenin Hills. "At first there was real fear," he said. "People shook their fists and shouted, 'Don't shoot your own people, turn against your officers.'" He saw women crying, people brought them food to eat, flowers to stick in their guns, leaflets from the White House, Yeltsin's appeal to the military to obey their oath to the people. The soldiers unloaded their AK-47s and kept them out of sight. "Why don't we make a U-turn and go home?" they began to say to one another. Chuganov and his friends felt ashamed, and they told the crowds around them they would do nothing to disgrace the names of their fathers. They would not shoot at their own people. At noon, Yeltsin went on the radio. "Soldiers and officers of the army, the KGB, and the troops of the Interior Ministry, countrymen, the country is faced with the threat of terror. At this difficult hour of decision, remember that you have taken an oath to your people, and your weapons cannot be turned against the people. You can erect a throne of bayonets, but you cannot sit on it for long. The days of the conspirators are numbered. Clouds of terror and dictatorship are gathering over Russia. But this night will not be eternal, and our long-suffering people will find freedom once again, and for good. Soldiers, I believe at this tragic hour you will make the right decision. The honor of Russian arms will not be covered with the blood of the people. At the White House, a retired lieutenant from the Taman Guards, Baskakov is my name, here is my tattoo, took command of Civil Defense Unit No. 34. He was proud to see that it was his boys who were the first to come over to the side of the resistance. Baskakov had quit the Communist Party the year before, and he felt that it was his duty as a Christian to come to the barricades. He never said a word to his family, just walked out the door and took the metro to the White House. Baskakov's men, a ragtag outfit of Afghan vets, took command of Entrance 22 of the Parliament, where key figures like Shevardnadze and Popov were going in and out. Baskakov's men spotted snipers in the windows of the Hotel Mir across the street and near the American Embassy. For years, American diplomats had assumed that the KGB used the hotel as a lookout point on the embassy. Baskakov's troops were pathetically armed with black market pistols, knives, billy clubs, and occasional machine gun. If there was an attack, they'd be cannon fodder, and they knew it. Everyone knew it. It was that combined sense of heroism and fatalism, especially among the kids who had joined the resistance units, that moved Baskakov. "I used to be critical of the young," he said. "But there were bikers, the rockers, going on reconnaissance missions on their motorcycles across the barricades, giving us news about the troop movements. The young girls that people call prostitutes, they were there giving us food and drink." The defenders of the White House came slowly, first a few thousand, then 10,000. By the end of the day, there would be around 25,000. With advice from the military men, they began building barricades, gnarled heaps of scrap, construction rods, concrete blocks, rusted bathtubs, bricks, tree trunks, even cobblestones from a small bridge nearby that had been the site of an anti-Tsarist uprising in 1905. The strike leader, Anatoly Malikin, showed up wearing a United Mine Workers Union T-shirt. "United we stand, divided we fall." He went inside and quickly strapped on a machine gun. Somehow, he said, he had had the feeling it would come to this when the first mines went out on strike 2 years before. At the airport in Leningrad, Sobchak's aides were there to meet him. They told him that the Leningrad regional military commander, Viktor Samsonov, had already been on television to announce that the emergency committee had taken power from Gorbachev and that a state of emergency had begun. So far, there were no troops into the city. Sobchak told his driver to take him straight to the city's central military command at top speed. Once he was there, Sobchak left his guards downstairs. I saw that they were bewildered and confused, and right away I didn't let them open their mouths, Sobchak recounted. I told them if they moved one finger, they would be tried the way the Nazis were tried at Nuremberg. I scolded Samsonov. "General, remember Tbilisi? You were the only one there who acted as a reasonable man. You remained in the shadows. What are you doing now? You are involved in this gang. This committee is illegal." "Why is it illegal?" Samsonov said. "I have an order. I have this coded cable. I can't show it to you. It's a secret." Sobchak pressed, telling Samsonov to remember how the generals in Tbilisi in April 1989 had also exceeded orders and turned a peaceful demonstration into a bloodbath. "Why do you raise your voice?" Boris Gadaspov, the Leningrad party chief, shouted. "Shut up," Sobchak said. "Don't you realize that with your presence you are liquidating your own party?" For the rest of the meeting, Gadaspov whimpered in his chair, a beaten dog. Samsonov faced a choice. Yazov and Kryuchkov had appealed to his commitment to empire and discipline. Sobchak, who had the support of the city, appealed to his conscience, his commitment to history. The choice was what the past 6 years had been all about. And the general found it almost easy. He backed off and ordered his men to stay out of the city. Leningrad, now St. Petersburg again, was saved. That evening, Sobchak went on the local television show, Fact, and referred to the conspirators as former ministers and as citizens, the way a Russian prosecutor would refer to the accused. Samsonov kept getting calls from the conspirators, but he held fast. Sobchak was pleased. "General," he said, "can't you see how these people are just nothing? They will not hold on to power long, even if they are able to seize it." The leaders of the junta had already failed miserably to follow the prescriptions of Lenin or Yaruzelsky. Nearly everyone on their arrest lists was still free and working with the resistance. The editors of a group of liberal papers, including Moscow News, had already begun planning a joint underground paper to be called Obshchaya Gazeta, the common newspaper. And the editors at Nezavisimaya Gazeta were also putting together a samizdat edition. Opposition radio stations, particularly the Echo of Moscow, would go off the air for a few hours and then return. Telephone, fax, and telex lines at the bureaus of foreign news organizations worked flawlessly. CNN, the BBC, Radio Liberty, and the Voice of America pumped out continuous coverage. Reporters commandeered phone lines inside the White House and called out their reports without a hitch. At the offices of the key Soviet newspapers, the situation was more complicated. The junta had ordered the shutdown of all the main liberal papers and used the high-circulation party and government papers to do nothing more than publish their decrees and spurious reports on how normal the situation was, how calm. Sovetskaya Russia was enthusiastically cooperative, some of the others less so. At Izvestia there was a war. Izvestia was one of the most paradoxical institutions in the country. On the one hand, its editor, Nikolai Yefimov, was a shameless sycophant. His patron was the parliament's chairman, Anatoly Lukyanov. Yefimov was only too happy to fulfill the demands of his betters. About half the paper's staff of 30 foreign correspondents were KGB operatives. Although official government censors no longer sat in the editorial offices, Yefimov was more than able to handle the job himself. He was always quick to kill stories that he thought might damage or insult precisely the men now leading the coup d'etat. On the other hand, the paper was brimming with talent. Mikhail Berger published some of the sharpest economic pieces in the country. Andrei Ilesh wrote a series of articles on the shootdown of Korean Airlines 007 that was more revealing and critical of the Soviet leadership than anything published in the West. The better reporters and editors, the honest ones, despised Yefimov. They thought they had the talent and the resources to report the news far better than even the young renegades over at Nezavisimaya Gazeta. If they only could. At around 1 p.m., a fight broke out in the composing room at the Izvestia plant on Pushkin Square. A few of the reporters had brought back a copy of Yeltsin's appeal to the people for resistance to the coup, and with the support of the printers, they had already set it in type for the evening edition. But Yefimov's deputy, Dmitry Mamliev, demanded that Yeltsin's words not appear. The printers were furious. Pavel Vichenkov, one of the foremen, shouted, "We voted for Yeltsin. You can publish the statements of the committee, but we insist on Yeltsin's statement going into the paper as well." "It's not your job to decide what goes into the paper," said Yevgeny Gamenov, one of Yefimov's men. "That's the job of the editors. Your job is to print what you are told to print." "You can shoot us," a worker, Pavel Bushkov, said, "but we're not going to put this paper out without Yeltsin's statement. We live the life of animals, in poverty, and we don't want our children to live the same way." Yefimov had missed the start of the battle because he was racing back to Moscow from his vacation house. As soon as he walked through the door, a small group of reporters surrounded him and demanded he publish Yeltsin's statement. Yefimov said there was no way and yanked the metal type from the printing press. Ordinarily, Yefimov would have had his way. But now the printers, like the Siberian miners or the factory hands of Minsk, said they would sooner quit than give in. They would sooner destroy the presses than publish Izvestia without the appeal of Boris Yeltsin. 20 hours late, Izvestia appeared on the streets of Moscow and in every city and village of the Soviet Union. The Emergency Committee's proclamations blared out from page 1. Yeltsin's appeal to resist the coup was on page 2. It was time for the junta to face the press. An early evening appearance at the Foreign Ministry Press Center was part of their strategy to put a face of normalcy on the situation, to create the impression somehow that this was not a putsch but a legal constitutional transition. This was their chance to compete on the evening news broadcasts of the world, to counter the image of Yeltsin, like Lenin at the Finland station, rallying the people from the top of a tank. In the first hours of the coup, Kryuchkov, for one, felt euphoric. There were no strikes, no demonstrations. Radical Republican presidents, such as Viad Gamsakhurdia in Georgia, made no move to act against the coup. Yanayev, for his part, wandered around his office and the Kremlin hallways. Other men were making the decisions. But this was his moment. At the press conference, he had to convince the people beyond the camera that all was well, that he was in control. The problem was that Yanayev could not control his own self. He sniffed like a smack addict in need of a fix, and his hands trembled like little wild animals quivering in front of him. He was lost from the start. His answers were transparent lies. His attempt at calm had the brittle ring of hysteria. The reporters, except some of the obvious reactionary plants, showed no fear or respect in their questions. They even laughed at him. Gorbachev had been stripped of his nuclear football, the case containing the codes. All the codes were now in the hands of the military and the KGB. A junta in control of a vast nuclear power. And they laughed. About halfway through the disaster, Yanayev called on a 24-year-old reporter from Nezavisimaya Gazeta, Tatiana Malkina. Just a year before, Malkina had worked as a low-level researcher at Moscow News, rummaging through the clips, doing scut work for the older reporters. Now she was a staffer on the hottest paper in Moscow. She got out of her seat, took the microphone, and fixed her eyes on the half-drunk pretender to power. "Tell me, please," she said. "Do you realize you have carried out a state coup? And which comparison do you find more appropriate, 1917 or 1964? The Bolshevik coup or the overthrow of Nikita Khrushchev?" For an instant, the man who would be king looked at his own wretched hands. He seemed sad, as if he wondered if the shaking would ever stop. At the Ministry of Defense, Dmitry Yazov watched the press conference with his wife Emma. She wept as she watched the pathetic spectacle, and begged her husband to call Gorbachev and call off the coup. "Dima, what have you joined?" she said through her tears. "You always laughed at them. Call Gorbachev." But the marshal told his wife that was impossible now. The connections had all been severed. Working out of a war room on the third floor, Yeltsin signed a decree creating a backup shadow government and dispatched a team of 23 civilian and military leaders in the Russian government to set it up in a secret headquarters 35 miles outside Yeltsin's home city of Sverdlovsk in the Urals. "The idea was to act in the name of the Russian government if the White House was captured," said Alexei Yablokov, Yeltsin's environment minister, and one of those who went to Sverdlovsk. Working in bunkers 30 feet underground that had been built during the Cold War, the Russians began sending an unending series of faxes and telexes calling on local organizations and governments around the Soviet Union to resist the decrees of the junta. The leader of the Urals military district was one of the most reactionary generals in the country, Albert Makashov. It had been Makashov who had run against Yeltsin for the presidency on a purely Stalinist platform. Now Makashov was telling his charges to round up any suspicious people, including cosmopolitans, the old Stalinist code word for Jews. But his troops paid little attention. The passions of the city of Sverdlovsk were with Yeltsin. More than 100,000 people staged a demonstration defying the junta in the main city square. There were no arrests. Valentin Pavlov convened a meeting of all the government's ministers at 6 p.m. Environment Minister Nikolai Vorontsov, the only non-communist in the group, took notes on the session and read some of them to Masha and me before they came out in the press days later. "It was a chorus of agreement," said Vorontsov. "Every minister but three expressed absolute support for the coup." After Pavlov repeated the tale of the counter-revolutionaries with their Stinger missiles and evil intentions, one minister after another rose to say the committee was their last hope. They made little secret that what they wanted most of all was a chance to stay in power, to hold on to the last sweet scraps of privilege. Vladimir Gusev, the head of the State Committee on Chemistry and Biotechnology, was a typical case, telling his fellow ministers, "If we step back even an iota, we will sacrifice our jobs, our lives. We will not have another chance." When Pavlov finished the meeting, he spoke with Yazov on the phone. Yazov could tell immediately that the Prime Minister, whom everyone knew as Mr. Porky, was drunk again. "Arrest them all," Pavlov said at one point. Yazov knew things were going badly. Where was the plan? He was beginning to think that the collapse of the plot would be better than its success. But he pressed on. The junta, of course, had banned the Russian Republic's new television station. The public would have no chance to see the puckish hosts of the news program Vesti. There would only be central television, and for news, there would be only Vremya, just like the old days. Even the best directors and reporters at Vremya knew they could not be heroes. They could not take to the airwaves with appeals for resistance. Their entire operation was riddled with informers, agents, and officers of the KGB. It was out of the question. Besides, all the really irreverent people had long ago gone to Vesti and the more liberal shows. But a young Vremya reporter named Sergei Medvedev watched the CNN feeds and decided he had to do something. His editors gave him an assignment for the 9 p.m. broadcast: film a feature on Moscow Today. The idea, he knew, was to show how calm everything was, how life is going on as normal. In fact, it was true. Much of Moscow, like nearly all of the rest of the country, did seem normal. People went to work. Some watched television and read the papers and tried to figure out what had happened.
There were millions of people who thought the coup might even do some good. And there were millions who could not have cared less. But Medvedev also made sure to fill in the rest of the picture. He got some brief footage of the scenes around the White House, the barricades, the protesters. He even included a clip of Yeltsin